Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Tuesday, June the 12th. As we like to do once a week, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. What a week. What a week. What a few days, really. What a 72-hour period for President Trump. Goes to the G7, then he goes to Singapore. These amazing scenes on television of the President of the United States and the leader of North Korea. Of course, it wasn't all pretty. There was the usual criticism from the media. President Trump cannot do anything right for some people. But I think they're losing credibility. I really do. When they go to those extremes. Speaking of losing credibility, Robert De Niro just made a total, complete fool of himself. I don't know how these people think that they're hurting Trump. In fact, I think they're helping him a great deal. We'll chat a little bit about the very sad news regarding Dr. Charles Krauthammer, one of our favorite political analysts. We'll remember on this day in 1987, President Reagan at the Berlin Wall saying, tear down this wall. And we say happy birthday to President Bush, who turns 94 today. And let me say hello to our friend Bill Katz up in New York. Bill, how's the weather?
It looks delightful. I have not been out. Being a writer, I'm not required by law to go outside. I occasionally do once a year, perhaps. But the sun is shining. The temperatures, people look as if they're walking around normally. Al Gore sitting there very dejected, you know, that the city of White Plains has not been flooded by global warming. But we'll perk him up. We'll bring him some coffee.
Well, Texas is, at least North Texas, is hot and humid, but that's the way it always is. But, Bill, I do want to just quickly say happy birthday to President Bush, who's 94 today. We've been to the Bush Library many times as Texas A&M, and I recommend that to anybody. Of course, we went there because we had two sons who graduated from there. But it's a great place to go. There's a lot of history. And I think when you turn 94, we got to light every candle and celebrate your life, Bill.
That's absolutely true. And you know, it's remarkable to see anyone reach that age, especially from his generation. It's now becoming rather common. You know, the idea of somebody living into their 90s, even 50 years ago, was
right.
Very rare. Now, we're not shocked when we hear it. We're not even shocked to hear somebody reaching the age of 100.
Yes, well, it'll be interesting. I don't know if he's now the oldest president, or I know President Ford was pretty, I think it was 93 or 94 when he passed away, something like that. So President Bush must be getting he must be in the top three. I know President Hoover, I remember reading, was 90, I think, when he died. So he's got to be among the two or three oldest presidents or ex-presidents ever, Bill, because I don't remember, I mean, I haven't checked this, but my gut feeling tells me that a lot of the 19th century, let's say that a lot of the pre-World War II presidents probably didn't live into their 90s, because, as you say, it was not normal then, Bill.
It wasn't. If you take a look at Franklin Roosevelt, who was probably the most important president of the 20th century, he was born in 1882 and died in 1945. 55, 65, he was 63 when he died.
Right.
Of course, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. But there were some in the early days of the Republic. And I don't recall what their ages were, but you know, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson died on the same day, 50 years
yes.
to the day after the Declaration of Independence. And I don't recall what their ages. I'm at my computer. I'm gonna look that up. Thomas
yeah.
Jefferson and see
well,
how
Jefferson
how
was
old
born
they
in 17. I think. Excuse me for interrupting you, but I think Jefferson was born because I saw this recently, born in 1743.
Exactly.
So that would have made him 57 plus 26.
Well, let's see. We got 57, 67, 77. He was 83.
Yes.
And
yeah,
that was a very unusual age because at the turn of the century, between the 19th and the 20th, I think the median life expectancy was about 50.
Right. No, so I think it's remarkable. Now, of course, President Bush has had some health issues, and we hope for the best. And this is probably going to be a sad birthday for him because – you know, when you celebrate a birthday with a woman, your wife, for 73 years they were married. Yes. So I'm sure that in that sense, this is a little sad for him. But anyway, I just want to wish President Bush a happy number 94. Bill, I quickly mentioned that this is Reagan's, the 31st anniversary of Reagan at the Berlin Wall.
Yes.
I remember that speech quite well. I didn't see it live because of the time differences, but I saw the newscast later. I thought that was great, that speech. I mean, it was like sending a message. Hey, tear down this wall. It's a different time. I thought it was great.
Well, it was great. And, of course, one of the things that made it so great is that the State Department was opposed to it, naturally. I mean, why do anything pro-American? And I think it was Reagan who made it very plain that the speech was, as many presidential speeches are, was sent over to the State Department for examination before it was delivered. They let other people look it over to see if there's any objection. And it came back that, yes, there was objection to that line, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And it was taken out of the speech, and Reagan put it right back in the speech. And it became probably the most famous line of his entire career. And what made it famous also is the fact that the wall did come down. Had the wall not come down, it might have been forgotten, but the wall did come down. And it demonstrates that occasionally we ought to do something that is unusual, unique, and positive. And it may horrify deep state and horrify the establishment. We were told before this conference in Singapore that it is reckless and irresponsible. It must not happen because it takes months for these conferences to be prepared. Well, I recall, and I was there, actually, in the CIA, that the entire Cuban Missile Crisis, one of the worst crises of the Cold War, was resolved in 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what these fellows are forgetting about you must take months to prepare is that a president of the United States has to be prepared to negotiate at any time, because he or she does not know what he is going to face the next day. And, I mean, we suddenly discovered these missiles being sent to Cuba, and the president had to be ready. And fortunately, Kennedy, who had suffered some setbacks in foreign policy, was ready. And he, I think, handled it very, very well. But this was a historic moment to watch. What is so sad is to turn on television this morning, and it's part of my job, and to watch CNN trying to wreck it, ridicule it, bringing on the anti-Trump crowd. I mean, my God, there was a time in this country when an achievement like this would have bipartisan support. And no way. Just hate. Let's figure out a way to hate Trump. Just
right.
So irresponsible.
It is. And what I also find irresponsible is this obsession with the preparation. As if President Trump was supposed to take class every night for the last 2 weeks about U.S.-Korea relations or something. I mean, the reality is that when these, you know, we saw this with Reagan, and we've seen it with other presidents too. The actual details are not, I mean, Kim and whatever his name is, Jung, and President Trump were not, deciding how many troops were going to be on the border there. I mean, Trump has an objective, and then, you know, we'll figure out the details when we get together. And the devil is always in the details, so that's why we always have to be careful with these sessions. But I think the biggest difference, Bill, what is happening now, I think there's been and we talked about it a few months ago, but I think it's worth remembering. I think there's a perfect storm here between China and President Trump. I think China has basically told the leader of North Korea, you got to do this. You got to do this because we're sick and tired of you. We're sick and tired of North Korea. We just don't, you know, this is not Mao Zedong in the 1960s in North Korea. This is a different China. And I think that's what it's driving this. The Chinese are fed up with it. And I think they told them, look, your country has to look more like South Korea so that we can sell you automobiles and products. And I think that's what is driving it, Bill.
Well, apparently President Trump brought with him a video that he showed to Kim, indicating what North Korea could be like in a new world. And look, I don't know. None of us were actually at those sessions, but they apparently went very well. People say, well, Kim took him for a ride. No, he really didn't. Now, Khrushchev took Kennedy for a ride at Vienna in 1961, but Kennedy realized it. Kennedy realized he had been rolled. Very smart man, and he was prepared for the Cuban Missile Crisis. But we really have the cards here, and that is what some of these naysayers don't seem to understand. Kim is not in a strong position. He's in a weak position, but he's in a position because Trump is such a good negotiator. He really is. Where he said you can be strong, you know, you can be a major world figure. You can have a strong economy. You can be like South Korea. And I think Kim probably said to himself, I have a choice between this and probable death.
Right.
Because the implication was always there. If you don't, you know, start to cooperate, something, you know, you might, as they say in organized crime, you might suffer a misfortune. And I think he understood it. I think he understands exactly what this is about. And I hope he goes through with it. Now, there are people who, as you immediately saw, and it's inevitable, were talking about, well, but look, Kim is now, as a result of Trump's inept diplomacy, on the level of the President of the United States. Is he? The man could barely pay his hotel bill.
Right.
When negotiating with the president, who could buy the hotel? What people don't understand is when you get attention, there is a downside. And Kim will get more attention now than he ever has had in his lifetime. But that means the spotlight is on him. That means sunlight is on him. And you know what Justice Brandeis said about sunlight. It's the best disinfectant. He has got to produce now if he wants to remain a world figure. Because if he doesn't produce, he'll go right back to where he is today. And I think he's probably intelligent enough to know that.
Yeah, that's right. I thought one of the best analysis of all of this was done by Senator Lindsey Graham, who I like a lot on foreign policy. I share a lot of his foreign policy views. I used to like McCain also had some great foreign policy views, but unfortunately McCain, sad to say, McCain is not watching what he's saying these days.
No.
But as far as Senator Graham, though, he said something very interesting. He said there's two, I'm paraphrasing, but he says there's two outcomes here, peace or war. We all want peace because nobody wants to see the millions of people who would die in a war with Korea, and it would be millions. Nobody wants to see that. So, you know, maybe the leader of North Korea has gotten that message either from China or from President Trump or both, but this is not going to go on. This, what we had here over the last few years, when he would fire a missile every 3 weeks and put on these shows, that's not going to be tolerated anymore. And I think he's starting to realize that, Bill. And the Chinese I still think the Chinese are the ones here who told them the truth. And the difference between China and the United States is that the Chinese will put a bullet in his head if they have to.
Yes.
Because it's a different culture, as you know.
Oh, very much so. And I think we would, too, under certain circumstances. We just wouldn't admit it. you've got a situation here where if things are handled well and if we can prevent the sabotage of the agreement from our side as well as from Kim's side, from the deep state, there's a chance here for a major breakthrough. There really is. And a chance also that this could influence other things around the world. I'm sure that the Iranians had their TVs on last night. And they probably didn't like what they saw. But they also realized, and President Trump said that, he was asked by one of the CNN reporters, how is this different from past negotiations with the North Korean government? And he said, truthfully, it's a different president. Now, what he was really saying is, I'm not Barack Obama. And I think that's probably the single biggest line to come out of this summit conference. I'm not Barack Obama. And reporters have got to get used to the fact that there is a new force in the presidency, and he does things differently. Whether he is successful, we won't know probably for 50 years, but at least he is pursuing these things. Now, when Barack Obama pursued these things, he gave up the store before he even started the negotiation.
Right.
When he went into negotiating with Cuba over normalization, I mean, it was a disgrace. Why was it a disgrace? You have to look at who people are. Barack Obama is a leftist, and Donald Trump is not. Barack Obama had no experience at negotiating anything, except maybe entry to law school, whereas Donald Trump is an experienced negotiator. Barack Obama had around him people like John Kerry, who was an appeaser, and Ben Rhodes, who was a poet of some kind, I think. I don't know what his background
That's right.
was. Whereas who does Donald Trump bring? He had around him Mike Pompeo, who's emerging after only 6 weeks as Secretary of State as a major international figure. John Bolton, people we could trust. You know, I've always said you can always tell a president by what names he brings. You know, a Barack Obama would bring John Kerry and Hillary Clinton and Ben Rhodes. And Donald Trump brought the USS Ronald Reagan, the USS
right.
Nimitz. You know,
right.
isn't it amazing the difference in the results they got?
That's right. And one of the reasons why I would always get so upset when they say, is he preparing for the meeting, is because I think that's an insult to people like Pompeo, like Bolton.
Of course.
Who I think probably had a lot to do with the detail. I mean, Pompeo, as I understand, and we'll know when the history of this is written, but as I understand, Secretary of State Pompeo basically negotiated all of this in advance. I mean, the meeting between President Trump and the leader of North Korea was formality, but everything had been decided before, which is amazing, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even during the night, I very heroically stayed up all night.
That's right.
I want the audience to know that.
That's right.
We're
if you fall asleep during the show, we'll cut you slack.
Well, okay. I usually only fall asleep when listening to speeches by liberals. You know, the point was made. Somebody made a very, very good analysis, and I wish I'd remember who it was. There were so many people on, saying that you have to realize at these summit conferences that they have to be translated. And so if it's a meeting lasts 45 minutes, it's really like a 20-minute meeting because of all the translations that are required. And they said this communique that ends the conference was not written during that meeting. It was written before it. I mean, it was done by Pompeo and whoever the North Koreans brought to the negotiation, and there was a great deal of preparation. It doesn't take months. You can do all
right.
this preparation in a matter of days, unless, of course, you want to depend on the old State Department crowd, which takes months to open an envelope. You know, shall we open it today? Shall we open it tomorrow? How shall we open it? What letter opener shall we use? You know, shall we use the one that Lincoln used? I mean, deep state takes months. When I used to work in Hollywood, I used to say that Hollywood, the industry that Hollywood resembled mostly was the federal government. There's a permanent government. It goes on and on and on and on. Never does anything, but goes on and on and on. And then there were the spark plugs who get things done. It's a remarkable moment. There will be an attempt to tear it down, but I think the American people will more than embrace it.
Right. It seems to me, though, that I think most Americans are going to look at this, whether they like Trump or don't like Trump, as everyone in the audience remembers. I didn't like Trump in the primaries. I was one of those who wanted somebody else. But he won, and he's actually turned out to be a very good president. If anybody had said to me during the primaries that we'd be where we are, I would have said whoever that president is deserves a lot of credit. And with North Korea, I think most Americans instinctively look at this and say, you know what, we may not understand the details and probably don't care about the details, but having a Korea Peninsula without nuclear weapons is better than having one with nuclear weapons. And they know that quite well because maybe they have a son in South Korea defending South Korea. I have a couple of guys at the church, Bill, have sons in South Korea. And you know, they see it differently than anybody else because if there's an exchange, their sons are in the firing line. So
of course.
I think most Americans look at this and say, hey, if we can get the nuclear weapons out of the area and if we can have peace in the area, who cares about this North Korean? I mean, the truth of the matter is the North Korean dictator without nuclear weapons is exactly nothing more than that. I mean, it's the nuclear weapons that give this guy credibility. Without these nuclear weapons, he'd be Raul Castro. Or, you know, he would be Ortega in Nicaragua. He wouldn't be anything of consequence, Bill.
Well, that's exactly right. And that is clearly the goal here. And there is one analyst who would disparage it immediately was some guy, so-called North Korean expert, who said, well, the document they signed calls for, it says we reiterate or something like that, recommit to a nuclear-free Korea. And he said, well, what does it mean, recommit? He said, they're making the same promises they made before. The difference is this is a different president this time.
Right.
And
in all fairness to the critics, it may not work. I mean, this thing may 6 months from now, we may look back at this and say, well, it didn't work out. And I understand that. Nobody has to, you don't have to love or hate Trump to realize that, you know, this thing may not work. The North Koreans at some point, for whatever reason, may decide to go back to their old ways. China may be different. Who knows? But at least as of right now, as my baseball coach used to say, you're always better off having a guy at second base than not having a guy at second base.
Exactly.
Because the guy at second base can score. The guy in the dugout cannot score. And that's kind of
how I
feel about this. Our position right now is pretty good, Bill.
I think so. And, you know, as Theodore Roosevelt said famously, the credit belongs to the man who is in the arena. Mm-hmm. And Trump is in the arena. And Nancy Pelosi isn't. I don't think Nancy Pelosi knows where she is. I think that's part of the problem here.
That's right. Yeah, Nancy needs, I think Nancy needs a GPS. Somebody needs to get her a GPS system, not just for directions and locations, Bill, for anything. Like maybe you have a meeting in 10 minutes or something like that. She doesn't look good at all. I don't like to make fun of people who are a little older, but she's not helping the Democrats, Bill. That's all I can
tell you. Well, every survey shows that. And actually, what is interesting about her is that among the Democrats, she is actually one of the more knowledgeable and one of the more reasonable Democrats. But she stayed too long. It's an amazing thing to think of her as one of the more reasonable ones. And Dianne Feinstein, who is running for another term in the United States Senate from California, the senior Democratic senator, couldn't even get the nomination of her party. Because she's considered too moderate. And Dianne Feinstein is a classical liberal Democrat. And the classical liberal Democrats are being forced out of the party by the hard leftists and the racialists. And when at the state convention, she was booed. Now, she won the nomination by going to a primary in which she absolutely trounced her opponent, which indicates that the Democratic people, voters of California, may not be ready for Marxism just yet. You know, they apparently are not ready for it. And she easily won the nomination, and she will probably be reelected at the age of, I think, 83. She is in her 80s, I know.
Mm-hmm.
But to see what is being done to that party, I mean, and to see the kind of behavior that they engage in, it is a tragedy. I think we talked about this before, that I feel that unless this improves in the next couple of years, and unless they win a big victory in the midterms, which is still possible, that there may not be a Democratic Party. That there may be the formation of a new political party of center-left Democrats to take over, because what you have now is impossible.
Well, it's not helping them, and I want to bring in, before we talk about the G7, we'll talk about the G7 in the next segment, but I just want to take a few minutes here in this segment and talk a little bit about Robert De Niro, I didn't watch the show, okay, but I understand it was one of these
and nobody
programs.
Nobody else did either.
Nobody else did either, yeah, that's one of the problems. When you said earlier in the show that you were watching CNN, I wanted to jump in and said, you must be one of the 400,000 who's seeing it because nobody else is watching it.
Well,
they're having
amazing?
A huge problem. Yeah, they're having
a huge rating
problem.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it has to do with them.
Well, sure.
But
you want to talk about De Niro, who got up at the Tony Awards,
which
is the awards with Broadway theater, which CBS, for some reason, runs every year, even though no one has seen in the audience has seen the shows. and engaged in an obscenity against the president. Fortunately, CNN has some kind of a delay, probably an 8-second delay,
right.
So they could bleep out the offending word, at least in the United States. I don't think they could bleep it out internationally.
Mm-hmm.
But the audience got up and applauded. And
right.
I don't think they realize the damage they do to themselves.
No, I don't think so either. And, you know, if these people think that this is the way they're going to get the public back, look, let me just ask you two questions, Bill. Imagine you were one of the advertisers on that show, and you're putting up some pretty good money to advertise on that show, even though they don't have a huge audience, but it still costs money. How would you react to that? And number two, imagine you're a serious Democrat who was in the audience because you like Broadway. How would you react to that? I mean, it's just these people are crazy. They're losing it
yes.
in front of us. I don't know how
well,
else to say
well,
they're
they are.
Losing their heads.
It's Trump derangement syndrome. And by the way, let's recall back to Bush derangement syndrome.
Yes.
Because on the left, there seems to be regular derangement whenever a Republican is elected. There is not one thing said about Donald Trump that was not said.
Oops, did I lose you?
No.
Oh, okay, I thought I had lost you there for a second, but I guess not. No, I thought for like a second there I lost you. I think I lost you when you said syndrome. Bush derangement.
Yes.
And then the syndrome part
went. I think we're being censored. Yeah.
I think so. Bill, let me take a little break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about the G7 and also Charles Krauthammer, and I'm going to connect what you were saying about the syndrome, the Bush derangement syndrome, with the author of that, the great Charles Krauthammer. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we're having our weekly chat with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, and we sure picked a good day to do it with the news of President Trump and North Korea. We're going to talk a little bit about the G7, but I want to bring in Charles Krauthammer for a second, Bill, because you were talking about Bush derangement syndrome. It was Charles Krauthammer who came up with that phrase back in 2002 or 2003. I guess a lot of people reacted to the news the way I did of Charles Krauthammer. I think a lot of us were really hoping that he would get back on that panel, because I loved him in that panel, and now
yes.
of course he won't be coming back, and it's not good news. But I think we're all going to miss him a great deal, Bill.
Oh, he was the best, and he was really the standard for commentators. I would say before him was probably David Broder. At one time, it was Walter Lippmann, who kind of went a little crazy. But I think in this generation, he is the one. It's interesting that while there was some hate mail that sites received about him when it was announced that when he announced that he was dying, there was some ugly hate mail. But most of the comments were very, very positive. The Washington Post, which is a liberal paper, which published him on Fridays, said it's going to be a different Friday without Charles Krauthammer.
Yes,
no, whether you agreed with him or not, he always maintained his civility. He didn't engage in personal attacks. He was very witty. He never pulled rank on anybody. And it's not going to be, there are no indispensable men, but I would say that in journalism, he came as close to being indispensable as anybody I've seen.
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult. You're right, not having that Friday column that he would write for the Washington Post, and of course those daily visits. And it got to a point, Bill, where he was almost like the face of Fox News opinion, if I could put it that way, because he used to be, it seemed like just about every night he was on with another show as well as the panel. So he was obviously a man with a great respect, and nobody ever, I don't remember anybody other than crazy people saying something crazy about Krauthammer, because whether you agreed with him or not, he prepared and said things in a proper way. So how can you hate a guy like that, Bill?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, and you know, there were people who did simply because they hate anybody who takes an opposing position. But his life story was remarkable. I mean, a man who was brilliant from the start, recognized as brilliant, and had a tragic accident while at the Harvard Medical School, which left him paralyzed from the neck down. And yet he endured, went through the Harvard Medical School. Professors would come to teach him while he's lying in a hospital bed.
Wow.
They had confidence in him. They would flash slides on the ceiling so he could see the visuals, became a board-certified psychiatrist, and then decided he wanted to go into journalism and won a Pulitzer Prize. No matter what he did in life, he did it. He did it well, and he did it with a certain style. And, you know, and I thought his letter announcing his impending death was in that style. And, you know, I think, I don't recall whether we said this off the air or on the air, I wish Senator McCain, whom I admire immensely, would learn a lesson from Charles Krauthammer and leave graciously instead of saying some of the things he's saying. I think maybe, you know, his wife could say, okay, John, it's time to go, and you know, just write a letter. Krauthammer showed us how it's done, and I think that he will be remembered for that. But there is nobody in journalism today who can replace Charles Krauthammer.
I always thought, Bill, that there's three people, I'm sure there's more than three, but there's three that I can remember who were very gracious as they were dying. John Paul II, Mickey Mantle, and now Krauthammer. Mickey Mantle, of course, died because some of the self-inflicted damage to his in his life. But I thought at the very end, you know, the last 30 days or so of Mickey Mantle when he was dying, the messages he was sending out were so great that, you know, he died gracefully, I'll put it that way. John Paul II, a man in incredible pain, the same. And now Charles Krauthammer. I think with respect to Senator McCain, and I love Senator McCain, I voted for him in 2008. I wish he had been elected in 2008. But the problem with John McCain, the solution to John McCain, I think, is for the governor to replace him. Because once he's no longer a senator, I think he doesn't have that microphone right away. But as long as he's a senator, then he speaks as a senator, and that, of course, gets him a lot of publicity, particularly when he criticizes President Trump, which is his right. But I just don't get what he's doing, Bill.
Well, I don't either, and you know it's a sad thing, and you know there was a story once told about President Truman that many of the letters he sent as president never reached their destination because his staff would tear them up, throw them away before they were sent, because Truman had that impetuous nature of sending out angry letters, famous one to a Washington music critic who had criticized his daughter Margaret's operatic performance. And I think maybe it's time for someone to, you know, maybe take some of the senator's statements and kind of toss them away before they get sent out.
Right.
Because we want to remember him as the great John McCain, the great hero. He was a hero, and he was treated very badly by Donald Trump. There's no question about that. It was the worst moment of Trump's campaign is when he doubted that McCain was a war hero. It was a low moment. I thought it was going to end Trump's campaign.
So did I.
And it didn't. And I think Trump at some point should have apologized publicly. You know, we've talked about Trump's other side, but you know, for whatever reason, he didn't, and I think it's now time to recognize that for Senator McCain to recognize this is his exit and to make it as gracious as possible.
Absolutely, and I think it would go a long way toward that if President Trump were to say publicly, look, I said something that was, I didn't mean it the way it came out, whatever, however he wants to say it. But I think it would do everybody a lot of good if we could put this beside or behind us, because John McCain deserves all the recognition in the world when he passes away. He deserves a funeral like a hero. He probably will get it. I've been a big fan of John McCain all my life. Over the last couple of years, though, I think he's, maybe he's taken Trump too personally.
I think so.
I think it's time to to move on, and for his sake, he doesn't need to pick fights with Trump to prove to the world that he believes in a strong defense and national security. I always thought those were his strongest attributes, national security and defense and all of that. And he doesn't need to prove it to anybody, Bill. He is John McCain, and that's all you need to say. John McCain is all you need to say, Bill.
Yes, and I think that one of the saddest things was the fact that President Trump really did, I think, insult McCain in ways that McCain thought he would never be insulted. I don't think mm-hmm. McCain ever resented political attacks or, you know, I disagree with you. But when you say about a man who has spent years in captivity being tortured, not being able now to raise his hands above his head because of the damage that was done, and to say he wasn't a hero, and I like people who were never captured, which is what Trump said.
Right.
I think he never expected to be attacked that way. And
No, not at all. And also by someone who didn't serve. This is the other thing that I think for many of us, and I'm going to take a shot here at President Trump. This happened 2 years ago, but I think it needs to be repeated. President Trump never served in the military. And I'm not saying that, I mean, neither did President Obama and President Clinton. So it's not like, you know, this is the first time. But it seems to me that when you have not served in the military, the last thing you should do is criticize anybody who has.
I agree.
Because,
yeah.
Man, when you go through what John McCain went through, I don't know that there's too many people, including Donald Trump, who would have been able to go through that. So I always thought that was Donald Trump's worst moment. I agree with you. I think we talked about this, actually, in the summer of 2015, how I thought it was over for him at that point. But he survived, in large part, I think, because there were so many other people running that he could win with 30% of the vote. And I think that had a lot to do with it. Bill, I want to move on to the G7 and put a couple of ideas on the table. The first one is that I didn't know that we had tariffs with Canada. I thought we had a free trade agreement. So that's maybe I'm learning something new every day. And I also feel, Bill, that these people who the three people who went to this G7 meeting and were most critical of President Trump, Merkel of Germany, Macron of France, and Trudeau of Canada, these three people have serious problems back home. So
yes.
Picking a fight with Trump is probably not a bad idea. I mean, if you're Trudeau and you've seen your approval ratings drop under 50% in large part because of some of the childish, foolish things that he's doing, such as dressing up when he went to India or whatever, that insulted the Indians more than anybody else. And
yes.
When you're Merkel and you have all the problems that you're having, and when you're Macron and you're the president of a country that cannot be managed, I mean, I pity anybody who's the president of France. I mean, it's almost as bad as the city of Chicago. You cannot govern country.
Absolutely.
So I'm not surprised that these three people would pick fights for Trump. That's kind of a long-winded way of saying that I'm not surprised that these three people would go to the meeting and pick fights with Trump. The wrong guy in the world to pick a fight with, as Trudeau found out, Bill.
Well, he did find it out, and I think also, once again, we find that the bought press will not report the story. You know, one of the things you learn in journalism is that classic set of questions, who, what, when, where, why, and how, that make up a news story. And one of the questions one asks about any Trudeau story is who. Who is Justin Trudeau? Well, the first thing you find out about Justin Trudeau is he's the son of Pierre Trudeau. Pierre Trudeau was the left-wing, anti-American prime minister of Canada, was always a thorn on our side, never liked us, a party animal besides. He and his wife, Margaret, were very big on the social circuit, and they were never particularly liked here. And here is the son. I think he came into office trying to be a somewhat more pleasant personality than his father. But the fact of the matter is he doesn't really know how to handle himself. He's not popular in Canada. His popularity has dropped considerably. And I think that he is now seen for basically what he is, a very immature, inexperienced politician who happens to have a famous name. And going to the conference, he apparently did something at the end of the conference, and we're not exactly sure what it is, that really got to Trump. But I believe in piecing together the stories that he was in negotiation with the American side, said some things in the negotiation, and then went out and contradicted them in a public statement which was critical of the United States. And I think that really got to Trump, because that's something you don't do. Now, of course,
right.
in Congress, immediately, the Democrats were siding with Trudeau. I mean,
right.
the Democrats
Amazing.
Would side with the devil himself if the devil was in a negotiation with Trump. But I think that Trudeau, you know, is going to have to, you know, calm down a little bit, recognize that Trump has just had a great moment, and that the next step should be to negotiate in good faith with the United States and come out with a reasonable agreement, and also
mm-hmm.
recognize the fact that Trump's argument is a basically valid one, that we have been taken to the cleaners repeatedly in these negotiations, and that we have given up too much and gotten too little in return. And
right.
now Trump,
and
Trump,
he needs to get different yeah. eyelashes too, Bill. I would recommend
that. He
does. That.
Yes, he does. And very, very young man. I think he was. And no matter what he is in years, he comes off as immature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people forget the fact that President Kennedy was elected when I think he was about 45, 46. I don't actually remember his age. Very young man, looked much younger. Looked as if he was in his 30s, and it hurt him when he was running for office in 1960. But Kennedy had a lot of experience on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as a legitimate war hero, as a member of the House of Representatives, as the author or co-author of two books that were not about himself, unlike Obama's. And he actually came to office with a good grounding in what
mm-hmm.
government should be. I don't know what Trudeau's background is. It doesn't
right.
seem he had much of one. But
no.
when you deal with the president, we've had a wonderful relationship with some Canadian prime ministers, especially
sure.
with the last one, Steve Harper, who
mm-hmm.
was very pro-American and who dealt with us in a very fair way. And I think that he might take a leaf from the Steve Harper playbook and recognize the fact that there is a right way and a wrong way to deal with the United States. And I think also Trudeau has taken press reports about Trump much too seriously.
Right, and I just think that it would have been better off if he hadn't said anything. Look, explain to the farmers in the Midwest, the dairy farmers in Wisconsin and Michigan, you know, explain to them why they should have a tariff. I was listening to some people the other night on a Sunday night talk show, and a couple of people called from Canada, and they were talking about this, and they're saying that Canadians, because of these tariffs, actually pay much more for milk in Canada than they do in the United States, that because of all of this protection of the dairy industry. And it just seems to me unfair. If you're going to have a free trade agreement, let's have a free trade agreement. But if you're going to have a free trade agreement that says, well, we can sell cheese in your country, but you cannot sell it in our country. Or I also heard that with the Europeans, a Harley-Davidson motorcycle in the United States will sell for X number of dollars and then triple that when it goes to Europe. Well, you can't do that. That's not free trade, Bill. If that's the way it's going to be, then let's scratch the agreement and start from scratch and you know, go back to pre-NAFTA, whatever you want to do. But I think one of the problems, and let me just say one quick thing here about this little fight with Trudeau. I don't think that people understand how President Trump is dividing the Democrat Party on free trade. I find it interesting. I have not heard anybody like the Democrat senator from Michigan or the Democrat senator from Wisconsin or the Democrat senator from Ohio. It seems like a lot of Democrats who were never for NAFTA, they're not going to come out and say, yeah, Trump is right. But they're not saying he's wrong either, Bill, which is the same thing, Bill.
Yes. Well, trade is one of those areas where party loyalty doesn't apply too much because individual
right.
congressional districts have individual problems. And that's why you find in Congress today a number of Republicans who disagree with Trump on this. It's because they have to report to their districts. And so trade is going to be a very difficult subject, and we may actually find members of Congress siding with foreign countries because it happens to be in the interest of their particular congressional district.
Well, you see that in Wisconsin. I mean, where are the dairy farmers concentrated? In Wisconsin,
yes.
In Ohio, Illinois and Wisconsin, probably Minnesota as well. And a lot of those Democrats in those states are not going to get angry at President Trump for talking about protecting our dairy farmers.
Yes.
I just think this is a losing argument for the Democrats, Bill, to not to defend American workers. Even if Trump is exaggerating what he's saying, and he may be, I don't know all the facts, but let's say he's exaggerating the negative impact of NAFTA, you're always going to win when you protect your workers, politically speaking,
of course.
That is.
Yes. Well, remember that these are the people who used to be the base of the Democratic Party.
Right.
And they are not the base of the Democratic Party anymore. The Democratic Party regards them as deplorable. When Hillary Clinton used that word during the campaign, which I think is really the thing, the one moment that killed her, she meant it. She meant it. Mm-hmm. I love all the stuff that goes on in politics. Don't you? When somebody says something really awful and then they apologize, and their allies say, well, she apologized for it. The apology doesn't mean you didn't mean it. You know, it just means you're just trying to cover yourself. I mean, you get this all the time. Well, he did apologize. They meant it, and I think the people out there in the Midwest and the South and the heartland of America know that she meant it because they have
right.
felt it. They have felt the abandonment. They felt the contempt. The Democratic Party today, unlike the Democratic Party of Jack Kennedy's era, is a party basically of coastal elites, of ethnic interest groups, and of college professors. And it regards itself as the intellectual party, as the superior party. When I was a Democrat, and I was very much an ardent Democrat as a young person, we were labor. We were proud to be labor. We didn't feel ashamed. We were proud to be labor because many of us came from immigrant families that worked hard. And to us, that was the labor movement, the workers of America. They were the heart of the Democratic Party. That and in the big cities, the Catholic immigrants, the Jewish immigrants. Now it's a very, very different political party with a very different base. And I think that some of the people still in the Democratic Party may wake up and realize the party isn't representing them anymore.
Right.
And we talked about this, the possibility that we will have a new party of center-left Democrats.
Right. I think there was a time, Bill, and perhaps you remember, I'm sure you remember this, that the Democrat Party was very close to the labor unions. I mean, the private labor unions, the manufacturers and exporters, that kind of thing. But now it's really become more a party of the public sector unions. And by the way, there could be a Supreme Court decision on that next week that could blow up that whole relationship. I'm sure we'll talk about it the next time. But so if you're in a private sector union and you manufacture this or manufacture that, you're going to be very sensitive to protecting your workers with free trade agreements. I believe in free trade, but if free trade means that the dairy farmers in Wisconsin cannot sell in Canada, then throw away the trade agreement and let's start from scratch, Bill.
Well, that may very well be true. Isn't it interesting that the president we now associate most with the workers of America is Donald Trump?
That's right.
I mean, a guy. But there is some method to that madness because, from what I understand, when he was in the construction industry, which is a rough and tumble industry, it really is, that he would have lunch often with the workers, not with the executives. And I think it was probably a great training experience for him. I think that being the kind of personality that he is, which is a gruff, rough, at times crude personality, he probably got along better with average Joes in the corner bar than with other executives. It's hard to imagine Donald Trump eating in anything but McDonald's.
That's right.
He's just not the kind. I can't imagine him reading a French menu.
No. No, I think he's a steaks and potato kind of guy.
Oh, very
and,
much so.
That's what he eats. He is. But I remember something that Donald Trump said during the campaign, and it reminds me of all of these, all this talk about protecting workers reminded me of something he said during the campaign when he kept complaining that he wanted to buy televisions for his hotels, but he couldn't find American televisions. He wanted to get refrigerators in the rooms. He couldn't find American. I mean, he was complaining that what we used to make at one time, we don't make anymore in
That's
the United
exactly
States.
Right.
And I think he comes from that background, having seen this. It's one thing to talk about theory, but it's another thing to actually see it firsthand. And I think he understands all of this very well, and I have to tell you that he is positioning himself politically to divide the Democrats on trade.
Yes.
And if Robert De Niro keeps apologizing to the Canadians over what he said about Trudeau, that just means to me that Donald Trump is going to be winning even more electoral votes in the next election.
Well, you know, I think if things go well, that's exactly what will happen. And I also think, and I believe you're seeing some signs of this, that he wants to divide the Democratic Party racially. I think he's going to make a play for the black and Hispanic vote.
Absolutely.
Especially the black vote. I think that he feels, and you can see it coming, I think he feels that he can reform or remake the inner cities. And I would not be shocked if Donald Trump got up one day before Congress, reached into his pocket, took out an instrument and said, "This is the iPhone 9. I have one, you don't yet." But and he will read on the back of it, "Made in the United States of America," and people will cheer. And he will promise that the people in the big cities, the inner cities, will get a chance to have an Apple plant or a similar plant in their area. And what is the Congressional Black Caucus going to do? Say no? We don't want it? I mean, I think he knows one thing that you see with Trump, he knows how to get away around the establishment. He may be crude about it. He may be crude about it. He is not a person who one expects to see at the ballet, but he, you know, as Lincoln said about Grant, this man fights.
Right. Exactly right. Well, Bill, as we look at the remainder of this week, obviously we have the post-Korea, coverage and all of that, or the post-Singapore coverage. But we also have a big thing coming up on Thursday, the ICG report. I'm sure we'll get into a lot of that the next time. A lot of expectations. I don't want to go too far with my expectations. I do think some bad things are going to come out, Bill.
I think so. I mean, you know, again, we have to realize there's been some pre-reporting, and it may or may not be accurate. But, yes, I think that it could be a decisive moment. And I also think we may be seeing the name Hillary Clinton again in ways that she would prefer that we not see her.
Right.
Because the Inspector General is very independent, apparently, and this whole investigatory mentality in Washington may be turned around to Trump's advantage. I say may, and I think the word may has to be emphasized. We don't know what's in the report yet, but I cannot imagine it being good news for the Democrats.
Right. I don't think the report – I agree with you. I don't want to create false expectations in my mind that they're going to arrest Comey on Friday or anything like that. But to me, it's a bad deal for the Democrats, or especially for Hillary Clinton. I don't see – I mean, what else could this report say, that she was treated correctly? I think everybody now realizes that she really wasn't given – the correct treatment, if I could put it this way, and that the FBI may have given her some advantages that nobody else would have gotten. I don't see how she can win with a report that says that, Bill.
Well, I think that's true. And it's something that may have impacts that go beyond the traditional impacts because we are forgetting there's a presidential election in 2 years. Which means there's a presidential pre-election, that long campaign we run in America, in 1 year.
Right.
And the Democrats are suddenly going to be faced with a situation where they don't have any candidates who are in effect, are clean, and candidates who can really make the race. It was reported yesterday, as you, I'm sure, noticed, that Barack Obama is tutoring possible candidates for 2020. My God, if there's one guy I wouldn't want tutoring me right now, it's Barack Obama.
That's it. The guy who lost 1,000 seats during 8 years. I don't think that he's the kind of guy that I want to see. You know, it's like a guy who just gave up 6 home runs and he wants to tell you about how to pitch to batters. Probably
that's
not a good idea. Not a good idea.
Getting grooming advice from a bald barber, you know.
That's right. Well, one thing I will say about the ICG report, we'll talk about it the next time we get together. But one thing I'll say about the ICG report is be careful what you wish for because you may get it. And that may be what the Democrats may be getting because I think they set out to destroy Trump and this whole thing may end up destroying them, Bill.
It can, and I what I'd love to see is if it is a devastating report, I will immediately rush to turn on CNN to see the other side, and what a terrible report it is. How badly written. Why, here is a typo on page 14. You know.
Right. You're right.
Yeah. I also want to hear, after this report is released, I want to hear how many times between now and November we don't hear the word impeachment.
Interesting question, yes. Interesting question. I don't know what it's going to say, and that's why I've kept an open mind about it, but I have a hunch that it's not going to be negative. But we'll talk about it on Sunday, Bill, the next time we get together. And as always, thank you so much for your time. And we picked a great day to talk about things.
We did, the
meeting in Singapore, so, and also with Reagan's anniversary. So, and again, happy birthday to President Bush. We'll close
Absolutely.
With that one, Bill.
Absolutely.
Have a great day, Bill, and we'll get together again on Sunday.
We will. Looking forward to it, Silvio.
Thank you so much. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We picked a good day to talk, I mean, with Singapore and everything else going on. Have a wonderful day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, where it's warm and humid, which just tells us that we're in summer. We're starting summer. We still have about 3 more months of this, so we'll see how it works out. Have a wonderful day, everybody. Thank you.